Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I am Richard Moore and I am joined by Daniel Freeb.
What's your name, Richard?
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
So, we've got a lot to talk about today. Lionel, I can see you're itching to describe where we are, but we'll get onto that in a minute. We're going to talk about the Vuelta. I'm going to reflect on Chris Horner's victory, Sati's decisive Angleroo stage. We're going to talk a little bit about the Tour of Britain. We have an exclusive interview with Chris Hoy. But before all that, Lionel, where are we?
We are in the Glasshouse Doors Public House in Soho, London, just along from the Rafa Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice, isn't it?
Very quiet.
It's the kind of place you'd come, if you're having an affair, you'd come here, wouldn't you?
Definitely. Definitely. Leather upholstered seats. Yeah. Lots of little nooks and crannies.
Yeah.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So here we are in the Glasshouse pub. Daniel said that there might be another circumstance where you'd come here if you wanted to get away from people. Daniel, what was that again?
A drug tester.
Mm. Yeah. That takes us nicely into a discussion of the Vuelta. I have to say today's story about Chris Horner and the hotel confusion over his drugs test has to be one of the most amusing stories of the year so far. It started off with shock and outrage that Horner had apparently dodged a drugs test because he wasn't in either of the two hotels that he was supposed to be in. It then transpired that the Spanish Anti-Dope Agency had gone to his original hotel and then guessed what hotel he might be in. Horner had updated his whereabouts information and he stayed in a hotel with his wife last night, and apparently all was well as far as his paperwork went. It does seem to be a mistake by the Spanish Anti-Doping Agency.
It kind of throws a spotlight on how the ADAM system works, doesn't it? Because an athlete can update their whereabouts at a minute's notice. So say, for example, they say right between, you know, my hour is going to be 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. at this hotel, whatever the hours were, at 4:59 p.m. he can change his whereabouts if his plans have changed and he is somewhere else. I mean, it's a system that's designed to try and make it possible for someone to declare where they are so they can be tested out of competition without being kind of pinned down to having to give details of every single minute of every single day.
Yeah.
But of course, it is open to confusion.
Of course. I think that there is also a spotlight on the Spanish Anti-Doping Agency, who presumably leaked the information about not being able to find them in the first place. And, you know, you have to wonder about the ethics of that.
Well, yeah, you are entitled to miss, or not entitled to miss, but you can miss two tests before you get into any hot water in any 12-month period, I believe. And so, really, the matter of a missed test is not really something that should be in the public domain until it becomes the all-important one.
Mm.
And I understand from speaking to riders that, I wouldn't say a majority of riders, but certainly a very sizable number have got one or two missed tests by their name.
But let's move on from that episode. Daniel.
One thing that did occur to me, I think the ADAMS system works pretty well generally, but
we should explain ADAMS as the whereabouts system.
Yeah, I mean, in some of the coverage about the supposed missed test today, it emerged that, I mean, Horner, this is the same as every rider, they give and their whereabouts for 1 hour a day. Now, Horner's, I think, specified that every single day he says where he is at 6 to 7 a.m. every day. Now, bearing in mind what we know about detection windows of certain products and how dope tests can be fudged, the ADAMS system and out-of-competition testing in general are clearly not any kind of panacea when it is only an hour. And you know, while they never know on which day a tester might show up, they certainly know to be prepared between 6 and 7 every morning, or in Chris Horner's case, that is when he might be tested. So I think there's a fair amount of latitude there for
potential foul play,
yeah.
Anyway, Chris Horner won the Vuelta. I think even last week when we discussed it, we were still kind of in a state of disbelief that a 41-year-old, we might have called him 42 at various points because he's almost 42, that a 41-year-old going on 42 could be on the verge of winning the Vuelta. But lo and behold, he did it. It started to become obvious, I think, on Friday that he was going to do it, and then on Saturday despite a valiant effort by Vincenzo Nibali on the Angliru. He attacked, I think, first with 6 kilometres to go, a long way to go on a steep climb like that. It was great to watch. It was fantastic entertainment. But Daniel, were you sure about Nibali's tactics?
Not really sure, Rich, no, because we've seen numerous times this year, and over the past few years, really, as I think we all believe the peloton has got slightly cleaner, we've seen fewer and fewer of these spectacular long-distance attacks, long-distance raids, and one consequence of that has been it just becoming apparent how easy it is to open up gaps of 10, 15, 20 seconds in the last 500 metres, last kilometre. So Nibali could conceivably have gone with that tactic, left his attack very, very late and gone very hard with, I mean, the Angliru flattens at the top. I think pretty much the whole last kilometre is flat. But he certainly could have delayed his move. I thought that would have been the more obvious tactic to go with. Perhaps he thought that by attacking repeatedly low down the climb, he was going to weaken Horner and bring about his capitulation.
I think that might be a phone call for Lionel. Yeah, it was surprising, but one thing I didn't really appreciate about Horner and his style of riding was that he doesn't, although he's a climber and a kind of pure climber, we tend to associate the ability to accelerate in rapid bursts with that pure climbing ability, but although he's a climber, he doesn't have that explosiveness. Maybe that's partly because of his age as well. I'm sure you lose a bit of that as you get older. Yeah. And so I think Nibali's repeated attacks, and he attacked him time and time and time again, were an effort to exploit that supposed weakness of Horner. And certainly he rode up the climb in a very steady fashion, didn't he?
Well, he did that. I mean, he was very smart throughout the Vuelta, wasn't he, Horner? He kept, in every single interview he did after a mountain stage, he talked about how he didn't go to the limit, how he was staying at 90%. And we see time and time again guys trying to follow brutal accelerations and then exploding. So really that is the way, whether you're that kind of rider who prefers a steady rhythm or not, I mean, history suggests that you're better served by leaving a little bit in reserve.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Let me just run through. I prepared some Oprah Winfrey-style questions. Oprah Winfrey famously opened her interview with Lance Armstrong with a series of yes-no questions. So I've got a few questions here, which I'm going to put to you first, Lionel. Or actually, I might put them to you both at the same time. Did you rejoice in Chris Horner's win in the Vuelta?
Rejoice?
Yes or no, please, Lionel.
No.
Daniel, no elaboration at the moment. You can go on to that in a minute. Daniel, do you rejoice in Chris Horner's victory?
Different question. You have to keep the questions consistent, Rich. Mine's do you.
Did you rejoice in Horner's victory?
No.
Who is to blame for that? The sport of cycling or Horner himself? That's not a yes, no answer, no. Obviously.
Who's to blame for that?
Yeah.
Neither.
Daniel?
Same. Neither.
Is it good that there was a sceptical reaction to his win? Is that healthy or is it corrosive?
Sceptical?
Yeah.
Healthy.
Healthy, I guess.
Yeah, healthy.
This is working well, isn't it?
Daniel, I thought it worked pretty well,
what
actually.
What a tremendous addition to the podcast this is.
We'll definitely do that again.
Fantastic.
But I think I can actually tease you apart here, as it were, because my sense is, chatting to both of you, is that, Daniel, you seem quite downbeat about the overwhelming scepticism that has surrounded Horner's win, whereas Lionel is perhaps something you are more encouraged by.
I understand the scepticism. The difficulty is, and you say corrosive there, because I think it's becoming corrosive to just isolate and pick on every single aspect of every single performance and then suggest that means a rider is doping. And I think we've had this discussion before during the Tour de France, but everything now is being seized on by admittedly a smallish number of people, but it's being used as an indication of doping. So whether dopers are people who ride consistently all year to a very high level, or they're people who have peaks and troughs in form, or You know, dopers are people who attack repeatedly or people who don't attack repeatedly and just ride at a very fast level. So basically, the problem we've got into at the moment is that every single race winner in the Grand Tours is going to face this scepticism, verging on corrosive cynicism for the foreseeable future, unless something is done to sort of break the circle.
But what, Lionel? I don't see anything that can be done.
Don't necessarily have an answer to that.
You were quite down, weren't you, Daniel, about the fact that we have not been, and that's the point of my first question, was the fact that there hasn't been rejoicing at Horner's win, and more a celebration of the incredible achievement of somebody winning a Grand Tour at 41, when no 41-year-old has even finished the Vuelta before.
No, no, I just look back and think back to the Festina scandal as this huge watershed moment. And since that day, when Willy Vogt supposedly took that detour, I think cycling's biggest problem has not been drugs, it's been belief and faith. And I still believe that's the case now. And that is what has become really corrosive, is the lack of faith. And I don't blame anyone for that, and I think it's totally understandable. I think it's just a huge shame for the sport, because you have to put every performance and everything you watch between parentheses. And, you know, I really just sympathise with the fans, because we were talking before this podcast, Rich, and as a journalist, there is so much still to enjoy and so many stories to tell in cycling. And within the context of a single race, there are so many interesting things happening that you can believe in. But if I was a fan and I made that emotional investment to follow the Vuelta every single day, and it's 3 weeks long, and, you know, I'm turning my TV on for 2 hours a day, 3 hours a day, then I'd be immensely disappointed and upset that it's very difficult to make that leap of faith and that emotional investment in the outcome of a sporting competition.
The thing is that the problem is the lack of faith in the dope testing efforts that are going on, which are probably at their most effective and efficient certainly in the time that we've been
when they
watching,
go to the right hotel.
When they go to the right hotel. Well, this is one of the consequences of this story coming out this morning, is that it gives the impression that the anti-doping system is kind of Keystone Cop style bungling goons who, you know, spilling test tubes of urine, and, you know, it's just a sort of haphazard approach to
one of our colleagues, Julian Proteau, did crack the joke that the mess up was because the Spanish anti-doping agency aren't used to testing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is that if you talk to people within the teams, the situation is that the anti-doping, the biological passport, is giving people a lot of faith that the parameters for doping have been narrowed down to, you know, a much greater degree than in previous generations. That doesn't mean it's been eradicated, and that's one of the problems. The biological passport isn't a yes-no.
Oprah Winfrey-style question.
No, unfortunately it isn't. And people will always say, well, about this missed test by Horner, well, how many times was he tested before the Vuelta? When was he tested? How, you know, and the problem is that there isn't enough information in the public domain to say these riders have been tested this many times. The last time they were tested was, you know, they've been consistently tested throughout the whole year. We're not in possession of that information. So people automatically ask the question, well, how many times has Horner been tested, or how many times has Chris Froome been tested? And that becomes a stick to beat the sport with, a stick to beat the athletes with, rather than having any faith that, unless you hear some kind of bad news from the anti-doping authorities, that a rider should be given a clean bill of health.
There's been some talk of, you know, the test today, although it was to be carried out by the Spanish anti-doping agency, was ordered apparently by the US anti-doping agency. Now, they've been investigating American cycling and American cyclists for some years now. They punished Lance Armstrong on the basis not of a positive test, but on witness testimony and so on. You'd think that if there was anything on Chris Horner, they would know it and that they would pursue it.
Well, like, they have tested him a lot this year, and they don't test a huge amount, USADA. I mean, and that's largely down to funding, and also because there are other agencies testing the athletes. But USADA, I think I'm right in saying, have tested Chris Horner 16 times this year, which is a huge amount.
Especially for someone who's not really been racing very much. You know, he's been injured for most of the year. And, I, you know, opening, keeping my mind open a little bit to the possibility that we have here a legitimate winner of the Vuelta, we must assume that. I think that there are reasons, despite his age, to believe that a unique or very unusual set of circumstances has conspired here.
Yeah,
I mean, Chris Horner has not raced much this year. He's had a strange career, as we've talked about. He's probably not burnt out. It was a very, very hilly Vuelta. He was racing against guys who have raced a lot this year who may not be at their best. There was a strange and a very unusual set of circumstances.
Yeah, but again, whether he's doping or not doping, we're in a situation where we're having to, you know, the business of watching sport is, why do we watch sport? We watch it partly because of our emotional reactions to it and our spontaneous emotional reactions to it. You know, if at the end of a three-week Grand Tour, everyone is just sitting around the table discussing whether something is logical or not, whether something is feasible, whether we should be able to believe it, then the spontaneous reactions, the emotional response to it, it goes out the window. And as I said before, from a fan's perspective, and I don't necessarily consider myself a fan anymore of this particular aspect of the sport, three-week Grand Tours, because
We don't want to be waiting for power data and times and
no,
so on. I think
exactly.
That this is my sort of my objection to that aspect that has grown up recently.
Yeah. Well, we're in a situation now where everything is kind of unbelievable until it can be somehow proved believable, and that is a really
unhealthy
position to be in. That doesn't necessarily mean just believing everything they've served up, but it does mean stepping back a little bit and saying, well, look, if as you say, Chris Horner's been tested 16 times by the United States Anti-Doping Agency and then tested by other agencies as well, then, you know, we have to take the fact that nothing's come out from those legitimate independent agencies yet as a positive thing. The problem is that when Daniel says there he's been tested this many times by one particular agency, which is an unusually high amount, which could be for a number of different reasons. One, it could be because he's been injured, he's been back in the United States a lot, so he's probably been more accessible to USADA than perhaps other athletes who are based in Europe.
Mm.
But people will seize upon this as, oh, well, they're testing him a lot, so therefore there must be, you know, no smoke without fire.
Yep.
And I think that becomes, again, it gets into the psyche of certain people who are unable to kind of just perhaps sort of step back a little bit. They're seizing on lots of little circumstances to add up to a, you know, basically guilty in the court of public opinion before we've got any actual facts to go on.
Yeah. Now, do you have anything more to add, Daniel? You look like you're poised to say something there.
No, just that Saturday was what, objectively speaking, would have been one of the great chapters.
It was an immense
in Grand Tour
stage,
racing.
Yeah.
But, you know, all I could register, all I could see were fairly lukewarm, ambivalent reactions to the whole spectacle. And very few people, as far as I could tell, were getting very excited.
And
there was
irony is there was nothing spectacular about Horner's ride on Saturday. It was a steady, measured effort.
Yeah.
The spectacular ride was done by Nibali,
yeah.
Albeit he blew. And you're watching him make those efforts. Those kind of efforts on such a steep climb you're always going to pay for them. It was a huge, huge gamble, and I say fair play to him for, you know, going all out for the win in the way that he did. It was win or bust, wasn't it?
I mean, in practical terms, I seriously doubt now, certainly in the midterm future, whether the sport can reinstill that belief that we need in order to have that emotional response again. But in practically speaking, I think really the UCI has to look at even intensifying target testing. And I'm sorry, people like Chris Horner, I'm sorry, people like Domenico Pozzovivo, who did the time trial of his life, which stretched the bounds of belief earlier in the Vuelta. But they have to be tested. They have to be tested maybe three times a day. They need to be tested in the morning. They need to be tested when they finish the stage. They need to be tested at night, and then again the next morning. And you know, that's where the money should be spent now, in order to get that belief back.
Yeah,
but that is how the biological passport was formed, was based on targeted testing. You know, back in the day when Anne Gripper was going through the introduction process, she was the anti-doping manager at the UCI, they made the very valid point that there was no point wasting money testing people whose profiles appeared normal.
Yeah.
The problem there is that you could have an athlete, for example, who the UCI tested maybe for example, in 2011, several times to establish whether or not their biological passport is wavering about all over the place. They've come to the conclusion that actually that's a steady, you know, passport that you would come in, you know, blood values that you would expect. And then, sort of 2 years down the line, it comes out that this particular rider has only been tested, you know, a very small number of times in 2 years, and suddenly the suspicion, you know, the doubts and the suspicions sort of swing round the other way and say, well, why isn't this guy being tested? So it's a system where, unless all of those figures are kind of put in the public domain, which they obviously can't be, we are stuck in this kind of catch 22 now.
Yeah.
And I say, I don't know what the answer is to
it. It all goes back to trust and faith, and how do you reinstill faith? Chris Hoy, in the interview that I did with him last week, talks a little bit about restoring trust in the UCI in connection with the forthcoming presidential election. But in this first part of the interview, he talks a little bit about a subject that is kind of related to Chris Horner, that of age and retirement, and the fact that he has no regrets after announcing his retirement in April this year. So here's Chris Hoy in London last
week. These links of yours are seamless, Rich.
Pretty good.
We've definitely got Future in Radio.
Here's Chris
definitely
Hoy
on TV.
Right, Chris, we're in a Evans workshop type place in London. What is it? Where are we?
Well, it's officially called the Biscuit Factory, although we're not here to make biscuits today, Richard. Nice little link there for you.
Nice. Yeah.
Today, specifically, I'm designing and finishing off three bespoke Hoy bikes, which we're going to give away as a competition. It's the colour schemes are all based around the colours of autumn, so it's... yeah, it's been a fun day, playing with bikes and putting stickers on and choosing the components.
This is your retirement project, of course. First of all, how is retirement going? I mean, it's about 6 months now since you officially decided to call it a day. How's that been? Any regrets at all?
No regrets, and everybody says it, but I can't believe how busy I am since I've retired. The nice thing is it's a balance. There's so many different things I've been doing. The bike project is the main one, really kind of committed to this, and this is my main sort of passion project, and hopefully financially be my future as well, if it goes well. It involves so much of your time. You know, I'm involved from the design process, the testing, the marketing, the promo, everything, and it's a lot of fun, and there's so much variation in it. Aside from that, you know, I get to actually ride my bike too, which is nice. It's an excuse to actually go out and test the bikes, and we're always developing new things. We're testing competitors' bikes, so it's really, really busy, but... aside from the bike project, I'm doing a bit of motor racing just for fun, which keeps that kind of competitive instinct satisfied. Doing stuff for the Commonwealth Games next year, I'm an ambassador for the Games. Doing a bit of mentoring with the Scottish team and hopefully with the Winter Olympic team for Sochi as well. Involved with Scottish rugby in a very small way for their advisory board. I'm working with various charities, still with some sponsors. And it just means that pretty much every day of the week, you know, 7 days a week, I've got something on, which is great, but... not what I envisaged. You know, I thought I might be able to just have the odd round of golf and
put their feet up.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there anything about training or, you know, competition that you do miss at all?
The biggest thing I miss is being in the track centre on a daily basis with the team, and it's just the sort of the connection with your teammates and the banter and the fun that you realise that you had. You know, at the time, you're just so focused on the day to day and the process and your performances and training. You look back and you realise it was actually a huge amount of fun as well, which is really nice to look back on, but I do miss it. You know, the people that you spend huge amounts of time every year, you know, probably spend more time with them than I do with my wife, or in the past I did. So to suddenly
you do spend a bit of time with your wife now.
Well, a bit more time, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I kind of envisaged it being much more free time, but yeah, I'm still busy now, but with all kinds of things. I do miss being part of the team. I miss the feeling of really working towards a major goal, but that's been replaced now with this project of trying to develop the bikes and sell them and make them a success and see people out riding bikes and enjoying them.
I mean, you are a bit of a self-confessed bike geek, aren't you? I don't think I'm insulting you by saying that. And equipment,
you've called me worse, Richard.
Equipment was always something you were very interested in as a cyclist, and obviously part of a British team that really pushed the boundaries, I suppose, in terms of what the equipment that they use, building their own bikes. So with your own range, what in particular have you been most sort of proud of, and what innovations, what aspects to these bikes that make them different?
Well, the biggest thing that we're really pushing and that we're focusing on is fit, making sure the bike fits the person that's riding it. And it's one of the things that really annoys me when I see people out in bikes. I love seeing people on bikes, but I hate when I see them and their saddle's too low, or the saddle's at the wrong angle, or the bars are too wide or too narrow or too high. They look uncomfortable, they're clearly not having a good time, they could be going a lot quicker for the same effort. And so many people pack in cycling that they don't do it for long. They get off the bike and they go, oh, you know, I've got a sore bum, I've got a sore neck, a sore back, I don't enjoy cycling. Whereas if you've got the bike to fit you properly, then I think people will get much more enjoyment and go a lot quicker on them. So what we try and do is we try and tailor the bikes to fit the customer. So when they come into Evans, obviously they pick the standard frame size, but in terms of stem length, bar width, crank length, you can all interchange them, which no other manufacturer does exclusively with a retailer. So it just means you can tailor fit it exactly to the right size, plus you get the right advice from the guys at Evans to make sure you leave that shop with the bike that fits you, that you'll be comfortable riding, you'll enjoy riding, and hopefully you'll keep riding for many years to come.
And in terms of the materials and so on, I know you've been out to the factory, haven't you, in Taiwan, and in terms of selecting components and so on, you know, how involved are you with all that?
Well, I get involved at every single stage, and I actually ride all the bikes myself, apart from the kids' bikes, which we're producing just now. We've got some younger test pilots for that. But, yeah, I get involved with every single stage, and, you know, we've opted for, so far, for aluminium as opposed to carbon for the frames. We go for a full carbon fork, but we believe that for the money, we can get a better quality aluminium frame, and then the money that you save on that, you can put towards the components. So you get better wheels, better gears, better brakes, even a lighter bike with aluminium than you would potentially with a lower spec carbon. So it really is about producing something that will perform very well, and at the same time look quite cool too, because we have focused on the styling of it. We've gone for very understated tones, sort of matte finish, you know, blacks and greys with a distinctive track band. So you've got like a red, black and blue band on all the frames and all the components, which we've taken from the velodrome, so it's a kind of little nod towards my past history.
Seen anyone out on one of your bikes yet?
I have. Do you know,
apart from Sarah?
It was a few weeks ago. In fact, it was only a couple of weeks after the launch of the bikes when they went into the shops, and I was in London and we were in a taxi, and believe it or not, Rob, my manager Rob, said, do you know what, it's going to be exciting when we see our first Hoy bike in the street. And a few seconds later, without exaggeration, a guy went past commuting on a Hoy bike and he went, there's one. I thought he was joking. I was like, yeah, right. He said, look. And there was one going straight past. I always envisioned that I would see the first person and run after them and stop them and say, how's your bike? So I didn't get a chance to see him. But the joys of Twitter mean that you can interact with people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get a lot of feedback online, a lot of positive feedback online from people that have bought the bike so far.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Welcome back. That was Chris Hoy. We'll play the second part of that interview a little bit later on. In the meantime, we're going to talk a bit about the Tour of Britain, because we've just watched the second rain lash stage in the Lake District. Shame that the weather's so bad, because Britain, the weather's not always like that, but people who are watching it will think it is.
Well, yeah, the Lake District can be pretty wet, even in...
Yeah, hence, Lake District.
Well, I mean, in terms of the weather, but the scenery...
That's
today,
like the lakes come from, you know, the lakes are filled by rain.
The scenery...
Not necessarily, Richards.
No, that's not quite true.
Indirectly, they are.
But the scenery was phenomenal.
It was.
And I dare say Scotland looked fantastic. The car
you dare.
Yesterday. You know, the finish there was really... It looked good on the TV, the laps around the grounds of the castle. The finish today in Kendal looked really good. With a steep finish at the end. And I think we've got more of that to come later
no
on
such
in the week.
Thing as bad weather, only inappropriate clothing.
Mm.
Lionel, you and I are heading off to Tour of Britain on Wednesday morning, early.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be on the race from then. We'll do another podcast from Tour of Britain later in the week. And you're looking forward to Llanberis. Llanberis.
Well, I've been
Llanberis.
Didn't he ride for Movistar?
Brilliant.
Wasn't he a former world marathon champion?
No.
Yeah, think of a different bloke.
In a word, no.
Oh, really?
No. It's where...
Think of his namesake, come on.
Llanberis is a place in Wales, Daniel.
It's where stage four finishes.
Yeah.
Starts in Stoke, finishes there in the shadow of Snowdon. I spoke to Dave Brailsford at the weekend, and that's his home turf, really. He grew up there. His father, I think, was a
mountaineering guide.
And so, you know, basically spent a lot of time on that mountain. He's ridden those roads when he was... you know, getting into cycling before he went off to race as an amateur in France. And one of the little things he told me was that earlier in the summer, on the Snowdon Mountain Railway, they have named one of the carriages the Sir Dave Brailsford CDE carriage.
No.
So people can take a...
Is it long enough to fit in all those letters?
Yeah, they've done it in quite a small font.
Okay.
But he did kind of joke that the passengers who are going up to Snowdon on the train tend to get into the other carriage, which is not named after him, which I thought was...
Good self-awareness,
yeah.
Dave. The interesting about that house that the Brailsford family used to occupy in that part of the world, and I didn't know this, but Dave Brailsford's father, John Brailsford, as well as being a mountaineering pioneer who invented a couple of nuts, famous climbing nuts, He was also a keen cyclist who in the 1980s used to host training camps. And one of the professionals who went and stayed in the Brailsford House in the 1980s was Shane Sutton. And I didn't know that the connection between Dave Brailsford and Shane Sutton went all the way back to there until quite recently. And seemingly when Dave Brailsford began working with British Cycling in the late 90s and sourcing bikes for them, he was getting a hard time because they'd gone with Concordia bikes over rally bikes. And Shane Sutton stood up in a meeting and said, "Are you John Brailsford's son?" And he said, "Yes." And he, from then on, stood up, sort of had Brailsford's back, and that was quite a significant moment in Brailsford being accepted by the British cycling community. So I didn't know that. Interesting. Keith Lambert was the manager of the team that Sutton was in those days, and so he and John Brailsford also go back a long way. And Keith Lambert, to complete another circle, is now back with British Cycling and looking after the under-23s. There you go. Some useful Brailsford knowledge. So Brailsford will be looking forward to that stage four, you think?
Very much, yeah. I mean, he was saying that he's hoping to be on the whole of the Tour of Britain with the Sky team, but there may be one or two things he has to go and sort out elsewhere. Urgent transfer business, possibly, or contract business. Or...
Do you have any information on that, Daniel?
No, I don't know. Actually, I'm a bit out of the loop, to be honest, Rich. I've been busy, as you know.
He wouldn't give anything away.
It's true.
But I think we've seen from the first 2 days of the tour that Sky are clearly well up for this, and by the time this podcast is online and people are listening to it, the time trial
they weren't too good today though, were they?
Well, I think they controlled the race pretty well. It was Gerald Schielek jumped through it then. Very good win for him. It was a hard old finish, wasn't it?
And the rider.
He's we've been joined by Dutch Daniel Freeb now, or Belgian, is it? But he's often sort of characterised as a pure sprinter, isn't he, Schielek? But he's much more than that. He showed that in Milan-San Remo. And then today, it wasn't a sprinter's finish, really.
It wasn't at all, no. I mean, Thomas Lofquist was away. Looked like he had it, but with the steep finish in the centre of Kendal there, his legs tied up on him a bit, and the riders in the chasing bunch were able to jump, and it was that combination for Schielek of being a kind of sprint finish, but hard enough to get rid of the likes of, I don't think Viviani was terribly close, and Cavendish was already out.
To see Nairo Quintana on the attack today with Dan Martin. I think Movistar also have ambitions in this race, perhaps with Alex Dowsett. Pretty much every race they've ridden this year, they've gone in with some kind of plan. They were very, very aggressive today. And Quintana, I must confess, is somebody I wondered if we'd see him at all week, other than at the starts in lots and lots of clothing. And it was, we saw him in lots and lots of clothing on the attack. I was quite surprised to see that. Were you, Daniel?
Yeah, but not sure he'll be able to do it on a rainy afternoon in Stoke Ridge.
If you knew your Tour of Britain route, you'd know that the stage starts in Stoke rather than finishes.
Usually a good finish at Stoke, isn't it?
It usually is, but it doesn't finish in Stoke this year. It starts in Stoke. Might be a good start.
Yeah. Will he be able to...
Daniel, you're not as au fait with the Tour of Britain as certain other races,
no,
are you?
Like, Daniel doesn't really count the Tour of Britain as proper cycling, I think.
That's not fair. Mick Bennett, if you're listening, I've always thought very highly of your race.
Yeah? Would you like to elaborate on that?
No, the Tour of Britain is a
bike race.
Very fine bike race. No, but I said in the last podcast, Rich, I think races which don't necessarily feature huge mountains and natural kind of obstacles that will break the race up, I think are vastly underrated. I mean, I think it's a much better race than something like, I know Lionel is very fond of the Dauphiné, but I think there have been some shocking Dauphinés in recent years. Ones with 50-kilometre time trials are just absolutely
as ever, the riders make the race,
exactly,
don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, the roads in Britain are wonderful for racing if the riders decide to race. And I think what's interesting is the Tour of Britain has become a better race because riders have started taking it more seriously. I'm not sure if that has anything to do with its
international
prestige. Yeah, World Championships.
I think it's mainly to do with the World Championships.
Yeah, there's that as well. But is there also the fact that Britain is now a market?
Yeah.
In world cycling.
I made that point about the World Championships, but I think I'm right in saying that the run of World Championship road race when he's coming from the Vuelta, it still goes back to 2000 or 2001. Mm. Tour of Britain has still never produced
a world champion.
Mark Cavendish started the Vuelta, pulled out, and then rode Tour of Britain, didn't he?
Yeah.
Just on the point of the roads in Britain, Alex Dowsett, I spoke to him as well at the weekend. And just, I wanted to know whether Quintana was going to make it here, because obviously they're Movistar teammates, and he said he believed he would be here, but he wouldn't quite
believe it until
he arrived at Edinburgh Airport, because there had been an issue over Quintana's visa and whether he'd make it here. Fantastic that he has done. One of the points Alex Dowsett made with the professional riders who race and train in Europe is that they struggle to kind of adapt to the fact that the British roads are a lot heavier than they're perhaps used to in areas where, in Italy, France, Spain, where the road surfaces are nice and smooth. Even our A roads are kind of quite grippy.
Tell me about it.
A lot of the country roads now are being topped off with where they throw down the stones and then sort of bed them into the tarmac and then let the cars kind of do the rest, and it leaves a very grippy surface. And he actually said that, you know, it can be sort of 10, 15, 20, 25 watts difference. You have to work harder for the same
speed. So our power date is going to be out for Caerphilly Mountain, Lionel. Little calculations that we're going to do on Caerphilly Mountain.
We're going to have to...
Enough to factor that in. Definitely.
Also, it's interesting that
grippy.
It is interesting, though, that when you see the way the race is being
ridden
now compared to 7 or 8 years ago, it is different, because the brakes are coming in quicker, the bunch is controlling a bit more, and I think that's because this year Sky and in previous years Mark Cavendish's team have done a lot of the work to try and keep it all together.
As a general point, what do we think of six-man teams? I mean, they tried it in Poland this year. I'm in favour. I think 9 or 8 or 7, well, certainly 8 is too many for a one-week stage race. When you have nine on the Tour de France.
I think at the Tour, the 9-man teams is fine, but on a week-long stage race like this, I think six-man team
is still a rarity. Six-man
team. You can see that a team like Sky is so strong, they can still control it pretty difficult.
Well, yeah, you say that, but there have been races in the days in the Tour of Britain where it's just completely exploded to pieces. It was last year, wasn't it? Cavendish and Wiggins out the back, and I think that was...
There was a couple of years, 2010, that mountainous, that stage into Wales, not Caerphilly, but the stage... Where was it? There was one. Was it Care? No.
There was the one in Swansea that went over Constitution Hill. Are you on?
That was perhaps it. Yeah, and it blew to smithereens that day.
Again, bad weather.
Yeah.
That was the HTC team putting.
Yeah.
So it could happen.
Yeah.
Just going back to the quality of the field, from having occupied quite a congested space in the calendar, suddenly. A window has opened up here for the Tour of Britain. The Giro di Padania has gone this year as well in Italy, and I'm not sure what else is going on this week, but there's not a huge amount of racing considering we're so close to the World Championship.
We've just had the World Races in Canada, of course. It was a busy weekend, but this week is a kind of quiet one.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Okay, welcome back to Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore with Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib. And in this little final part, I'm going to be introducing the final part of the Chris Hoy interview. We should mention Graeme O'Bree, who had a mixed week in Nevada last week. He has got a world record for the prone position in the bike, so it's nice that he's got something. I think he's probably returned with new respect for the whole world of HPV racing. I would love him to go back at some point.
I don't know, why doesn't he go for Fred Rompelberg's 268 kilometres an hour behind the
car? Yeah. Well, because is that not mainly about the athlete, whereas this...
No, what? Not at all.
No, is it
Rompelberg,
not? Is it about nerves?
I did a story on this a few years ago. Jeroen Blijlevens, the former TVM sprinter...
Yes, he went for it. Yeah.
No, he was going to take it on.
Ah.
And I interviewed both Rompelberg, the current holder, and Blijlevens, and I asked Blijlevens whether Rompelberg was a good athlete, and said, no, he's rubbish.
Maybe he would say that, though.
Well, but...
Yeah. So what is it then? That's basically the speed record behind the car.
You're sitting behind a car with a huge
sort of foil type thing.
Yeah, and you have to sustain the speed for maybe 100 metres. It might be less, but it's very, very dangerous.
Oh yeah, very dangerous. You don't want to fall off at that speed, do you?
No, Rompelberg broke 28 bones in his body on one.
So what build, one what do you need to do that then? I mean, apart from a very fast car with a huge foil and a smooth road.
I think that's basically
his grippy British roads wouldn't be much good for that. Graeme O'Bree then, he's returned, and we're going to have a Graeme O'Bree special at some point actually, coming up soon as a podcast. So we'll review all that with him, find out about his experiences there, and look ahead to what the future holds for him. Chris Hoy, in this final part of the interview, he talks a little bit about the future stars of British cycling, and also the UCI presidential race. He has been officially backing Brian Cookson. He came out in support of him last week. Talks a little bit about the need to restore trust and faith. Can we talk very briefly about the UCI presidential election? It's coming up in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about it more probably the week of the election. Brian Cookson seems to have the support of the European Cycling Union now. We don't know yet how the scores are looking in terms of the votes. There are 42 votes from the various confederations, the five confederations. So getting the support of Europe is a huge step forward for him. Lionel, any thoughts on the UCI presidential race? It's been a pretty undignified affair so far.
Yeah, it hasn't been great, has it? And one thing that strikes me as slightly odd is the number of press releases coming out from both the Cookson and McQuaid camp to try and sway public opinion
when the public
has no vote on this, and cycling fans don't have a vote, the teams don't have a vote, the riders don't have a vote, it's just the confederation. So it's just this kind of phony war going on, and it's become a little unedifying to watch point and counterpoint go back and forth. Whether or not you back McQuaid or think that it's time for a change, as I do, I don't think that this kind of the way this battle is being fought, and you know, the battle over Europe being wielded as by Brian Cookson as a sort of big step towards victory for him, which it may well turn out to be.
Well,
but
there's
a lot more to it than that, and it is still, let's not forget, a secret ballot in which, you know, we won't find out who voted for who after the fact. All we'll know is that the president is either Cookson or McQuaid. So all of this kind of preamble.
Yeah, I hear from reliable sources, or sources anyway, that Pat McQuaid was very, very confident of getting the European support at the meeting on Sunday, and so that will have come as quite a blow to him, apparently.
Yeah, I think that's more of a reflection on Pat McQuaid's judgment than it is on.
Yeah, perhaps.
Whether he was ever going to get that. No?
Perhaps, yeah.
The problem is that I think Brian Cookson done a much better job of putting into the public domain what he hopes to do if he is elected as UCI president, and there are a lot of encouraging things about his kind of manifesto, but the way the battle is being won, you do wonder whether after if he is the president, you know, he's got a huge job on his hands to try and unify the sport.
The question I ask myself is, how would Brian Cookson have handled USADA last year when they were investigating Armstrong and Pat McQuaid was pushing them away, proving very resistant, denying their jurisdiction on the case, appealing against their right to adjudicate on the case? You know, I ask myself, how would Brian Cookson have handled that? And I certainly hope that he would have cooperated with them rather than acted as though he didn't want the truth to come out. And I think that episode is the biggest blight in a way on Pat McQuaid's record, and I think that's the reason why he should not be elected president again. And I think he should have stood down last year when the USADA report came out. And you know, there is this dossier now that has been compiled apparently by Igor Makarov into the conduct of the UCI, Pat McQuaid and Hein Verbruggen. And McQuaid wants this dossier to be handed to the UCI Ethics Commission. Now, this Ethics Commission has done nothing with the USADA report, which contains some serious accusations and allegations about the UCI. The UCI Ethics Commission has ignored this completely.
Well, Pat McQuaid's modus operandi is for the UCI to investigate itself. You know, it very much the way he sees the governance of the sport is that the UCI should be allowed to do what it wants, and you know, investigate itself in a case, should there be a case, and decide whether there's a case to answer. And I don't think, you know, I don't know whether Brian Cookson would be able to change that particularly, but he's certainly set out on a path to make the UCI more accountable to outside bodies. You know, having McQuaid declare that the Ethics Commission is going to look into something is equivalent to just putting the files in the bottom drawer of the cabinet and leaving them there.
Some of the problems, I think, line law also, you probably agree, endemic to sporting federations en masse, and you know, there is a problem on the level above the UCI and the other federations, which is the IOC, which is the body that they're answerable to, and they don't really do a whole lot in terms of imposing that kind of transparency.
They have, you know, after the Salt Lake City scandal, they Dick Pound was the one that led a kind of review of the IOC in terms of bidding process and so on. And as far as I know, there hasn't been another scandal in a bidding war. We've just had the Tokyo awarded the Olympic Games. I think the rules are, I think the rules are adhered to now in terms of how host cities bid and whether they bribe officials and so on.
Yeah, I mean, this is a much wider issue, but if you fly to Geneva and then drive round the lake to Aigle, where the UCI is, you see the signposts telling you that UEFA is this way and FIFA is that way, and the
IOC,
you know,
is that
all the different sports are in headquarters all the way around
the
lake.
It's the most expensive real estate in Europe.
Yeah, and really, if you want to solve the problems of the UCI in one go, you would relocate it away from Switzerland and have it somewhere where it can be genuinely transparent and accountable.
Stoke. Yeah. Stoke. That's a brilliant suggestion.
Lanaras. The place in Wales that you said.
He writes for Movistar.
Yeah, which with the place. That
yeah,
place.
Daniel, have you managed to, you've got your thesaurus and dictionary here. Have you managed to use that during this podcast?
Not yet.
Right, well, that's about it. We're going to play out with the Chris Hoy interview, and we're going to be back later in the week. Lionel and I will be back, certainly, with Tour of Britain podcast. Daniel and I next week will be podding from the World Championships. So
I haven't booked my ticket, lots, I might not be able to go.
Lots of pods coming up.
You booked your ticket?
Of course I booked my ticket, Daniel. Come on.
I'm supposed to be on holiday this week.
Oh. Anyway, we'll be back later in the week. Here's Chris Hoy, and we'll see you later in the week. What about racing? We had the World Junior Championships in Glasgow recently. There seem to be some great endurance riders coming through the British system at the moment. What about sprinters? Is there another Chris Hoy or Jason Kenny coming through?
Well, I think there's another Victoria Pennington, certainly. Danielle Kahn was outstanding in the sprint. Kieran, team sprint, 500 metre time trial, did really, really well. I think she won 2 golds and I think a silver. She might have won 4 medals, actually. You lose count when they're winning that many, but... I think she has a great attitude, and she's really, you know, obviously got that instinct that you need for the sprint events, that kind of almost unteachable element that you have to have, and she's doing really well. As you say, that the team pursuit for women, I think they got gold and they won numerous events in the endurance side of things. But the sprinting side, it's almost harder to find them, I think, because they're born rather than being made, if you like. So it's about every now and again you see this diamond in the rough that comes out, and then it's down to the coaches to sort of shape them and make them into champions, and already we've got one with Danielle, and hopefully there's a few more to come too.
You can't make people fast, can you?
It just comes down to genetics and to the muscle fibre composition, and you know, you can improve your endurance, everyone can improve their endurance, but sprint wise we're kind of limited by the composition, the percentage makeup of fast twitch muscle fibres.
What about the future, Chris? I mean, a lot of people, we've had a recent IOC election for IOC president, we've got a pretty bitter campaign going on at the moment for UCI president. Maybe that'll put you off the idea of going into sports politics, but a lot of people have mentioned that that could be an avenue for you. Are you interested in that?
No. I think the more you see of it and the more you learn about it, the less it appeals, or to me, the less it appeals. It's just, I'd rather try and get involved at levels where you feel you can make a bigger difference and that you can make, you know, quicker changes. I just hope that Brian Cookson, if he does get in, that he's able to really make some positive changes to the UCI and the way that cycling's run. Just I think most of the cyclists I've spoken to over the last 10 years just feel a bit disillusioned by the leadership, you know, by the way that they feel their sport has been represented. And that's not just track cyclists, that's road guys, that's mountain bike, BMX, across the board, really. And we all feel the pain when your sport is dragged through the mud and when people have taken drugs and have brought the sport into disrepute, because it reflects on all of us. You know, whether or not it's someone in your discipline or your event is almost irrelevant. So I think cycling has had some really, really tough times, and it's time that we kind of came out of that era and we had someone to lead the way that's going to hopefully sort things out or help sort things out.
I know you came out publicly in support of Brian Cookson the other day. You know him well, obviously, from British Cycling. What kind of president of the UCI can he be, do you think?
Well, I hope he's going to mark this the start of a new era, and just, he's a cyclist, you know, first and foremost. He listens to cyclists, he comes and talks to the riders, and when he's been president of British Cycling, that's what he's done. He's actually taken on board the comments and suggestions from other people with a view towards making the sport better in Britain without any real personal agenda, whereas, you know, it doesn't feel necessarily that's been the case in the past with the UCI with different presidents, but who knows? I mean, I certainly believe that he's optimistic that he can make a change and that he can get stuck in there. It won't be easy, it won't be an overnight fix, but it's certainly a step towards, you know, I think regardless of what you think of either of the candidates, I think everyone would agree that it's time for a change and that cycling needs to have a fresh start.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Pleasure. Cheers.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvents.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.